My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Balder Hagerts, and we are back with the Western Bubble podcast. Today, we're looking back at the year 2025, and also kind of what happened with the Western Bubble. But first, it's my absolute pleasure to welcome back Balder, because you were sick last week. So I'm very happy that you're back and that you're healthy again, more or less. And I want to ask you with that, have you made any New Year's resolutions already for you or for the Western Bubble?
I know, it's good to be back. Apologies to the listeners that I might still be a bit sniffy or coffee or something like that. But yeah, it's good to be back, and it's always a little bit bittersweet to be at this time of year, right? The last episode of the year. We've gone through an awful lot of content this year. New Year's resolutions. Now, maybe we need to be a little bit more optimistic and positive. It's hard to find in today's pessimistic dark world, but there is often a tendency to just look at the negative downsides, and maybe in 2026 we need to offer more optimistic alternatives.
We can certainly try our best doing that. So looking back at this year, we recorded, or this will be episode number 37 for this year, which is a lot. I'm always very proud of us for this. And looking back at the topics or at the episodes of this year, there is a common theme, and that theme is Donald Trump. I don't think it's that big of a problem, because he's the most powerful man in the world, and it's his first year of his second term. And there's certainly a lot of things happening right now. We've seen an enormous acceleration of the Western Bubble. But it was a lot in the end, and I think it is worth it to talk about it one more time, kind of recapping what happened this year with Trump. And as I promised last week, the first thing that we need to talk about is the new U.S. national security strategy, because that came out last week when we couldn't record an episode, and there are still a few things to discuss for this topic.
Yeah, and I think that it goes beyond Trump being the president of the United States. If we had been recording in 2017 during his first year, during his first term, there's no way that we would have put so much emphasis on him. The thing that gives him so much importance this year is, by the way, typified by the national security strategy in many ways as well, namely that he has made very, very explicit how the West is losing control internationally, and how the West has given up on its leadership role and its idea of being at the top of the hill, and how internally, in his case within the United States, the West also is rudderless and is in a situation of huge disrepair, where the basic fundamental foundations that have been built up over the past few hundred years are now being very quickly taken down by Trump and people around him, as well as failing neoliberal dynamics, etc., etc. So it's not just a matter of, hey, we pay attention to Trump because he's president of the United States. It's also not just a matter of, hey, he's just a strange man who deserves attention. It is just that he has accelerated the decline of the West in ways that I would never have held possible even a year ago.
The comparison between his first presidency and his second presidency is striking, because I remember in 2017, he was just a funny man, right? Who would say he basically was uncontrollable, and he would say funny things sometimes, and then you could observe in real time all his advisors and the people working around him trying to calm everyone back down and say, yeah, he said this, but he didn't really mean it, this is what he really meant. And now we are observing a Trump unhinged, and everyone around him not trying to control him but enabling him. And there is this. I don't know if I mentioned this in a past episode, that I went to an event with in November, it was with some of the editors from The Atlantic, right? So and around Jeffrey Goldberg, the guy who was invited into the group chat by Hexeth and Vance, and we talked about that, and that's something that happened this year. And they kind of mentioned, because one of them was basically the White House reporter for The Atlantic, and they mentioned that the rule now in the White House is that if Trump says something twice, then he really wants it, and we just think about how do we enact it, right? Apparently he says a lot of very crazy things, of course, right, behind closed doors. And if he says it once, everyone kind of just laughs and chuckles along. But if he says it twice, they actually enact it without really questioning it, right? Because that's what Trump wants, and Trump got us here, and Trump is winning, and so on and so forth. And I think that kind of summarizes the beginning of the second term, and with this 2025.
Yeah, and I think that the lesson that has to be taken away from this is not so much that Trump is different. I mean, you call him a funny man. We've had conversations before about when you say that you find something funny, and I don't find it necessarily funny. But in his case, I don't think he's radically altered who he is between now and 2016 or 17. What has changed is what you're mentioning, the environment around him. So the destructive nature of Trump was always there as like a wrecking ball of basic institutions. But during the first term, those basic institutions still had strong walls, and the wrecking ball couldn't do what it wanted to do. He couldn't get away with it. And we know at the time that he often got very frustrated by it. Now, during the second term, almost immediately, from almost even after November when he won the elections and he wasn't even president yet, you noticed that those walls were about to fall down and that he got all of a sudden free rein to be fully himself and to be essentially put into a direction by his surroundings that would radically alter the way that politics and institutions function in the United States. And that has been so scary to observe, right? So in some ways, the first term was very uncomfortable. It wasn't haha funny, but it was limited in its damage because we knew that there were still American institutions that had been built up since the 18th century and that were doing their job. Those institutions now are gone, and it's horrifying to observe how a political system that was once celebrated across the world as the light on the hill has now collapsed in front of our eyes.
Right. Whenever I say haha funny, I think most of the listeners will know by now that the only way to protect myself in international relations is cynicism. But of course, I think it's much for putting it into context once in a while. Let's actually talk more in detail about the national security strategy because, I mean, the obvious things first, this is not a very intellectual document. It's badly written. It's badly structured. There's almost no coherence. It's shorter, much shorter than usual documents. And those are kind of the obvious things, right? And that is in line with this lazy, very ideologically driven White House that we observe, right? Is that this seems like some of Elon Musk's interns, right, who were heading Doge at the beginning wrote this.
Yes, absolutely. It's even if you take any politics out of it and you don't look at content, it is absolutely astounding that such an important document, and this is an important document, the National Security Strategy is a annual report that basically lays the foundations of how the large institutions that work on security, Pentagon and others, what their overall direction is supposed to be, right? And it is astounding how poorly written it is, how it lacks any kind of clear focus, clear analysis, how it feels like little bits from every department are basically put together, like, you know, made by committee, right? That always happens to a certain extent, but then there's supposed to be an intelligent author who puts it all together in a coherent framework, who takes all the feedback from all the departments and says, okay, how can we make this into something else? And yet this document is a document that displays enormous incompetence. And that is unfortunately very much in line with the current White House. And I would argue with right-wing populism in general, right? Right-wing populism in general, and Trump, of course, is the vanguard of that. does not care about expertise. They do not care about competence. In fact, they often feel threatened by it. They want to eradicate it because they don't like people who are smarter than them. They don't want people who know more than them. And so you have this tendency among right-wing populists to basically deliver very shoddy outputs. And this is very, very clearly one of them. And that's without even going into any of the content of the document.
Well, let's go into the content of the document. And as you said, this document nicely summarizes Donald Trump in 2025, and all, therefore also Donald Trump within the Western bubble this year. Because throughout the year, we recorded quite a few episodes about the topic of, okay, how should Europe react to this, right? So it started early in the year of just a lot of criticism towards Europe again from the White House. Then there was the whole, I don't know, because it does feel so distant. I don't know, so I don't know if anyone remembers, but the Oval Office fallout, as we called it, right? So the basically Trump and J.D. Vance inviting Ukrainian President Zelensky into the Oval Office and basically staging a whole falling out of relations. And then a week later, we talked about, and I like the episode title, Breaking Free, What Europe Must Do in a Post-Atlantic World. Right, so we kind of, so you saw this already in February. Then in April, suddenly you had the tariffs, and right, so the Trump tariffs really kind of really hitting Europe hard. And there we talked about what are reasonable answers to the Trump tariffs, and actually criticizing the, well, I mean, so you criticized the fact that that these answers had to be reasonable, and I kind of argued for that. And then a few months later, actually, I came around to see your point of view more, because I agreed that the reasonable answers haven't done anything for Europe. And now we're at the end of the year, and there is yet another affront, right, to Europe, after the Oval Office fallout, after the tariffs, after all the other insults. And now you have this national security strategy that basically says Europe is lost. If it continues down this path as a civilization, not as a civilization, it will basically end to be the European civilization that we all like and love, which, for context, right, is an idea of white supremacy, what this White House is currently advocating for. And so this really seems like the last, nail in the coffin for the transatlantic relationship, but without Europe realizing it, because there's not really that reaction from Europe. It's almost like this toxic relationship that maybe some of your friends are in, and you keep on telling the person that, hey, don't you see how badly your partner is treating you, and they keep on making up excuses. And that appears to be the relationship between Europe and Trump.
Yeah, I would argue that European leaders, they are of course aware of all of this, right, of these documents, but they simply do not have the answer, and they do not have the vision to look beyond just managing the fallout of these kinds of things. They have decided that they want to keep the United States as a friend. By the way, I think everyone should be in favor of long-term friendly relations across the Atlantic, but sometimes you need to, you know, speak truth to your friends. And the Europeans have decided they don't want to do that. They want to manage Trump. They want to pacify Trump. And as a result, they are not interested in creating some kind of alternative narrative. But of course, what I argued at the time, and what is even more blatantly obvious right now, is that Europeans need to understand that their future is not automatically connected to the United States. And if they want to have any kind of reputation on the world stage, they need to signal to themselves, to their own populations, as well as to the outside world, and I'm talking about Asia, Africa, Latin America, that they have a voice of their own, and that they will not be bullied by the White House. They're one of the few, Europe is one of the few places that can withstand US bullying, because it's strong enough, it's important enough economically, diplomatically, etc., etc. And so that might cost some short-term capital in Washington. It might create some problems in the short term with American counterparts, but in the long term, it tells Europe towards itself, as well as to the rest of the world, you know, you want to do business with us, respect us, and we'll respect you. But if you disrespect us, then you're going to pay a price for it, right? And this document is very, very, I mean, I don't even know if the word disrespectful applies or just a declaration of aggression, because basically what it's saying is Europe is on the wrong path and we will put Europe back on the right path. They need to go back to a sort of nativist approach, a white supremacy approach. They need to go back to keeping Europe from Islamifying or what else, whatever else the White House is concerned about. And they're explicitly saying we will support those groups who advocate that. So we will meddle with European politics. We will support the Farages in the UK, and we will support the AfD, and we will support Vox in Spain. And thereby, we are going to transform European society to something that we like. Well, that is essentially saying we will decide what Europe needs to do in the next 10, 20 years. And that's, of course, absolutely outrageous. And that is way more aggressive than anything, for example, the Kremlin has said about Europe, right? I mean, we always talk about Kremlin meddling in European politics, but at least they do it low-key. The United States does it blatantly in front of everyone's eyes. And the fact that European leaders have not reacted to that is, you know, a huge sign that they do not take their responsibility seriously.
I mean, the usual response to a statement like this from an unfriendly country, one should say, right? So again, this is confusing here. But let's take Russia, the example you just brought up, and let's just assume for a minute that Russia had said this. The normal response would be, oh, we're going to even further reduce your embassy personnel, right? And we're going to make sure that that basically the activities you can have within Europe are limited, right? And so we've seen this already with, again, after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. We see this with Russia today, right? The Russian state television that's being broadcasted in Europe. But you don't see anything along those lines for American soft power.
Not at all, because they are desperate not to ruffle Trump's feathers. They are desperate to keep Trump appeased, even though this horrendous kind of language, which also, by the way, is then followed up by policymaking, is coming out of the White House, is coming out of Washington. But it's you mentioned Stockholm syndrome. Europe, on the one hand, suffers from this idea that somehow the United States is still a friend, even though they're going through a rough patch. And secondly, that Europe needs the United States, otherwise they're doomed. Now, that is, of course, not helped by the fact that Europe is putting itself into this anti-Russian frenzy. There are only that many fights you can fight, and Europeans, having convinced themselves that Russia is an existential military threat, means that, you know, maybe they feel that they cannot take on Washington at the same time, being afraid to be squeezed between the two. But of course, that is a whole other problem by itself, because that a lot of that delusion about Russia is based on hot air. It's not actually real. Whereas Washington and the words coming out of Washington are real, and the pressure from technology firms coming out of the United States to change European society, to undermine European control when it comes to privacy and all that, is real, right? So on the one hand, we're fighting ghosts in Moscow, and we're not actually dealing with the true threats that Europe is facing.
There's another way in which Trump is very helpful to look back at this year, and I think one of the reasons why so many episodes maybe were a bit darker and our outlook on the world isn't as positive is because there is so much conflict in the world at the moment. And I mean, Trump claimed that he has ended most of those conflicts, 8 of them in total. I thought it was very interesting because I keep on trying to understand which conflicts he ended, because I never could count to 8. And now I saw in an article from 2 weeks ago from US Today that they specifically asked the White House, hey, which 8 conflicts are we talking about? And they said, well, we're talking about six conflicts this term, but there were also two last term. So they also include them, which finally makes the math work, at least according to their own statements. I don't know. For me, whenever you look into the news right now, and this is more so than ever before, you see about conflict somewhere, right? So whether it is the situation in Sudan right now, which is clearly the worst, or I mean everything we've seen covered in Ukraine and Gaza, but all the way to the DRC, or now the escalating tensions between Cambodia and Thailand, it's a lot, right? So just in general, looking at the world, this is a dark year.
Yes, and that increase cannot be seen separate from the decrease of global institutions, right? Global institutions are no longer relevant in international relations in 2025, not in any significant way. I mean, there, you know, you can point at the UN that there are still departments that have positive impact here and there, but it's very clear that the whole framework that was set up by the United States and allies after the Second World War, and that took so long to build in the 20th century, has been taken down. And nowadays, nobody cares about the UN General Resolution anymore. The ICC is almost irrelevant because even the United States is going after them. There is no global mechanism to deal with local conflict. Now, those mechanisms in the past, we would have criticized them for being too Western, too moralistic, too much based on the Western bubble, Western delusions. But they were at least there, and they would increase the price for local leaders to commit acts of violence. And on top of that, they would increase the price for international actors, companies or countries, to actually get involved in those conflicts. And now, in the absence of those institutions, those frameworks, with the UN and these other organizations no longer actually having any clout, there is no cost to both local actors to engage in conflict and international actors to be part of that, whether it's for economic reasons or political reasons or whatever. So this increase in localized violence around the world is not a coincidence. It's the result of an anarchical world where humanity as a whole doesn't try to mitigate the worst excess of violence anymore.
Let's look at some of these conflicts in detail, just because we have, of course, also covered them throughout the year in the episodes. So one of the conflicts that Trump claimed to have ended was the one between Iran and Israel, which, I mean, again, to me, it just seems so very distant, right? It seems like this was 2 years ago that that Iran and Israel were exchanging missiles, and that you would kind of wake up in the morning, and because there's a 2-3 hour delay on the time zone, you kind of see, oh, this and this happened, right? Iran fired some missiles at Israel, or the other way around. And then Trump claimed to have ended it in the funniest way possible by becoming part of the conflict, right? When the United States actually attacked Iran, right? For no reason. But since then, Balder, because we speculated about this, that now you no longer hear that Iran is this close to the bomb.
Yeah, that's good, right? Because they were just this close. They were this close to the bomb. And now
just like the last 20 years.
This is a pattern. If you go through the entire list of conflicts, this is what you will see coming back, is that, of course, there is no real solution to any of these conflicts, certainly not one provided by the White House. We're talking about ceasefires that are useful for the parties involved. Israel right now wants to keep its head down a little bit, doesn't want to be noticed too much. That's also why it's keeping its, it's not keeping the ceasefire in Gaza, but it's just doing enough not to be accused of breaking the ceasefire. Let's put it like that. Iran right now is also not interested in escalating. Iran has, by the way, never really been interested in escalating anything in that sense. And so basically what Trump is doing is he's giving these conflicts cover to simmer. They continue to exist. They continue in some ways to grow, but not to be overtly visible to the rest of the world. And that fits his narrative, like Trump the peacemaker, but it doesn't do anything for long-term stability or long-term human well-being.
I mean, it's basically, I think most leaders have now cracked the Trump code. And if I had to summarize it, it is in the FIFA Peace Prize, right? That, I mean, again, I'm going to call this man a funny man because there's no other way to describe him, right? Where FIFA said, oh, that he wanted Nobel Peace Prize, he didn't get it. So we will make up a peace prize and we want to hand it to them. But Trump decided by himself, let me just put the medal around my own neck because that's what people do. And this is just why I think he's incredibly funny, because that's, for lack of a better term. Right, but of course, FIFA is doing this to have Trump on their good side, because the World Cup will be in the United States next year. But this is something we've seen with many other countries as well, right? Where, I mean, for example, between the DRC and Rwanda, I mean, they were just really happy to give Trump a cool photo off, to claim to have solved another conflict. But we know that the situation in North Kivu is actually worse than before, and that the fighting continues.
And behind the scenes, the DRC is working hard with China and other actors to try to somehow consolidate or at least stabilize the situation. While Rwanda, of course, is happy for the whole world not to pay attention to it. It's a very common pattern, this, like, appease Trump, make sure that he feels recognized and that he can go back to his voters and say that he made peace somewhere, and then move on from there. The problem that I have with all of that is certainly from, once again, sorry to go back to Europe, but from a European perspective, is where is your respect? Where are your basic values? And that is not just a matter of emotions, right? All these countries that are falling in line to basically pretend that Trump is who he wants to be, they are basically signaling to the United States and to the rest of the world, we're pushovers. We have no value of our own. The only thing we care about is play the game so that Trump doesn't get angry with us. What an embarrassing situation to be in. If you're the DRC or the Rwanda, what are you going to do, right? I mean, it is what it is. But if you are a larger country, for heaven's sake, could you please stand up and show the world that there's an alternative to this bootlicking?
Well, I mean, you could also just name a street after him, as they did with Armenia and Azerbaijan, right? Another conflict that he solved. As you said, none of these conflicts are really resolved, right? They're just, you basically put a lid on the pot and you wait for it to boil over. Maybe with the next presidency. What I find interesting, or where I'm wondering, because there's a lack of consistency, which is, of course, no surprise with this White House, is theoretically that national security strategy said the United States doesn't care about the world. It doesn't want to be seen as a light on the hill. We really don't care. But still, Trump is so obsessed with being observed or perceived as this peacemaker. Right, because we know that his crowd, the MAGA crowd, doesn't care about peace in the world. They don't even care about peace in their own country. But it's still that he has this personal need to be perceived as the peacemaker.
I mean, one always has to be very careful, or one shouldn't diagnose. I mean, we're not psychologists. We have to be very careful with putting psychological labels on people. But it's so clearly a sign of deeply entrenched narcissism that is now being enabled by his entire surroundings, right? It just, in Trump's world, it needs to be about him. And for some reason, global leaders have decided that is the way to go about it. Just give him what he wants, let him live in his own dream scenario, and everyone can be happy. The problem is, of course, that while doing that, you are destroying an awful lot of basic values that the world should be defending and espousing. And that's the issue. I don't care about whether Trump feels good about himself. I don't care about the man. What I care about is that by going through this process of feeding into his narcissism, the world is essentially making itself a worse place.
Speaking of the world becoming a worse place, this is the last kind of trend that, at least if you look at the episodes that we recorded this year, occurred within the Western bubble. And that is, on the one hand, the decline of this neoliberal world, and artificial intelligence, right? And so both, I mean, again, many times these things go hand in hand. But we are clearly seeing that neoliberal frameworks are collapsing in front of our eyes. And at the same time, right, those politicians who previously have benefited from these neoliberal frameworks, they do not have the, I don't know, maybe intellectual capacity, or at least they do not understand why this is happening, but are actually really happy to keep on working on the demise of the neoliberal order with cuddling and cozying up to big tech.
So a major part of Western bubble delusions, as always, and we've discussed this many times, it has been, was in the 1990s, this idea that the economy would manage itself and we only needed managers. That we only needed people to keep interest rates low, inflation low, unemployment low, and everything would be fine. And the big problem with all of that, well, there are a number of them, but one major issue is that neoliberalism inherently, when there is no ideological political narrative to limit its reach, leads to this enormous wealth transfer from the middle classes, also the working classes, but especially the middle classes, to the top 10%, the top 1%. And that creates an unsustainable model, right? That is not just a moral concern. That creates a model where neoliberalism in the end eats itself. It just doesn't work anymore. If wealth gets too unequally distributed, at some point the system collapses. That's what we are seeing quite clearly at the moment. We're seeing that happen in front of our eyes. And on top of that, that gets accelerated by this AI boom, where AI is very actively a predatory force on a lot of people's jobs, a lot of people's livelihoods, etc. Controlled once again by the few at the top who have accumulated all that wealth over the past 35 years. And what you see is that politicians have been so trained to think in these neoliberal terms that they're not understanding their own role. Once again, it's just like with managing Trump, this is about them thinking that they can manage the economy, that it's all about getting the sharp edges off, instead of being a bastion against the excess of neoliberalism and AI, right? Politicians need to be there to defend the sanity of society, to make sure that society doesn't fall back into some kind of feudal system where there are very few at the top who basically, out of the goodness of their heart, distribute resources to the plebs. That is what politicians are there to avoid. And yet, they are incapable, they're incompetent, they're not understanding their role. And it's one of the reasons why populists, both on the right and the left, are doing so well at the moment. Not because they actually have the answers, but because at least they're portraying an image of something that they want to achieve, whereas that middle class of leadership in the Western world does not have any vision of what they want their world to be in the next 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And it's heartbreaking to see. And then you've got those tech bros, you've got those billionaires who control all those tech companies, who are pushing for even further delegislation, and they do that under the guise of no one has anything to worry about, because soon we will all be living under the riches of AI, and no human being has to work anymore, and we will all have universal basic income, and resources will be infinite, completely ignoring, willfully, I would expect, the fact that if we were to get to a situation where there's true abundance, where there's true abundance in terms of resources and human beings can just sit back and let technology do the work, that would require enormous political change. You cannot depend on a few rich people at the top being benevolent. It needs a political system that automatically redistributes a lot of that wealth. Otherwise, it's never going to work.
You don't believe in Hobbes, the Leviathan?
Hobbes would probably not believe in today's world, because, I mean, so the answer is no. There is more to a author to a government, to a state, than imposing an authoritarian system to keep us from killing each other. There's more to the Leviathan than just keeping security in check and making sure that we don't kill each other. There's more to it, and we've seen that over the past 400 years, that society is much more than that, and the role of the state and the role of the government is much more than that. But on top of that, this is not an Hobbesian question. This is a question of how do you distribute the enormous wealth that exists? And anyone who thinks that, oh, as long as Musk and Bezos and the others that are out there are, you know, nice enough to share their wealth with us, everything's going to be fine, are completely deluded. We know in a political system there needs to be automatic property ownership rights of wealth for the middle classes. If they don't exist, then the system will not work and lead to authoritarian oligopolies, authoritarian dynamics where the very few at the top basically abuse everyone else. And people seem to think that is not something we have to worry about right now, that we don't have to have those radical changes that lead to a redistribution of the promised wealth from AI and technological change.
I mean, for me, we don't even have to look at the developments of AI to see where this is going, because let's look at the developments of the internet. Of course, the internet, I mean, I would still claim that overall the internet is a net positive for the world. Because otherwise, for example, we couldn't be doing this, right? The two of us wouldn't be able to record this podcast. One of us sitting in Berlin, the other one in Madrid. But at the same time, politicians are still struggling to kind of maintain the internet in a way that isn't absolutely destructive to society. I mean, just now, 20 years after the first social media platforms emerged, our countries thinking about banning social media for teenagers, right? Because we know very clearly that social media is terrible for teenagers. Also for adults, by the way. I would actually claim social media is probably worse for people above the age of 50 than below the age of 15, because keep your parents off the internet, people. No, because I mean, what we've seen, right, with the rise of the populist right and left, with social fabric eroding, more hatred, right, more mis and disinformation, all of that. So we already see all these problems. We still see politics struggling to regulate that in a way that basically there is a clear net positive for the internet of the world. And at the same time, we're completely embracing this next step, which will probably just make it 10 times worse. I'm always reminded of everyone telling me, when I was still in school, that, oh, be careful with the internet, be careful with Wikipedia, because anyone could write anything on there. And I always try to argue, well, with Wikipedia, actually, there's quite a rigorous editing process. And, right, Wikipedia is a great starting point to understand difficult topics. And if I want to understand them further, I go to the sources. Right. So that was the early 2000s and the internet. And the very same people who warned me about the dangers of Wikipedia will jump onto Facebook and believe anything they read on there. And now they will look at these AI-generated images and start believing what's happening there and not being able to detect or differentiate between AI and the real world. So this is my concern, right? Is that politicians are still trying to catch up with the internet. And at the same time, they're fully and completely embracing new developments of AI because we don't want to miss out in the global race, right? Because whoever has AI is going to basically control the world in the future. So therefore, let's keep the tech bros happy so that they will develop AI in our country and we can kind of reap the potential benefits.
In many ways, this is a matter of power dynamics, right? So whether the internet is a net positive or not, those questions, it depends on your definitions. It depends on how you measure it. But the reality is that the internet is here. And the reality is what you just said, that political leadership has found it very, very difficult to make it as positive an impact as possible on society. you know, the not letting teenagers access social media might be a step in the right direction, but it's basically a patch for the wound, right? It doesn't actually deal with the underlying problems. And at the same time, you see, even in Europe, which outraged me, a push for example, all kinds of privacy laws to be broken, chat visibility to governments, right? And then that it gets done under the guise of, oh, we have to fight pedophilia or we have to fight terrorism.
Exactly, terrorism. No, I was just going to throw in terrorism.
Yeah. Like those kinds of boogeyman that we all get terrified by. And therefore, it should be possible, not understanding and not having a vision of what the internet could and should be and what it shouldn't be. The incentives that exist right now for leadership to actually radically alter the online landscape are overwhelmed by the personal incentives of being close to large tech companies, of the lobbying that occurs, also the way that politicians can personally benefit from the very rapid technological change and all that. So we live in a world where the wrong people are in this position of not understanding their proper duty towards society, towards the future. And they go along with their immediate incentives without any kind of broader vision. And it's scary. It should keep us all awake at night in some ways, because it is a very dystopian future that we're heading towards, right? Where very little control is left in the hands of society, very little control is left in the hands of state. All the controls accumulated among the few very wealthy. And if anyone, I want to reemphasize this, because people seem to live in cuckoo land sometimes with respect to this. If people really believe that those billionaires that are now pushing for those changes, at some point are going to wake up and say, and now we're going to create a very equitable kind of arrangement, political arrangement, where everyone benefits from our technological progress. These people are insane if you believe that. Of course that's not going to happen. We're heading towards a world where a very small group of people control almost everything that matters in terms of economic and technological progress. And where is our leadership? Where are people standing up?
Those are questions that we will answer next year, because in line with the... Right at the beginning of this episode, talking about New Year's resolutions and maybe wanting to be a bit more positive, let's at least end the year on a positive note, because it also makes sense to look back at the year for us as the Western Bubble Podcast. And I mean, I think it's safe to say this has been our best year so far, right? When it comes to listeners, when it comes to engagement with listeners, we published our 100th episode, which was, of course, very exciting. And it's one I still very much recommend to all listeners, and again, we published another 37 episodes this year, so that was great. That was absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, very enjoyable. Something that just started as a, you know, fun little hobby to do on the side is growing into something much bigger, which is exciting to observe.
Yeah, now it's a big hobby. And as I already talked about last week, there's some changes coming up for next year. Where we want to improve the podcast based on your feedback. Because of that, we will take a slightly longer break than usually to properly prepare these changes, to make sure that everything is then running smoothly, and that your podcast experience with us will be even better than in 2025.
I very much look forward to Dario, and I think for now we should just wish our listeners a very Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Exactly. Right. And any other holidays you're celebrating, right? Have some lovely time off. Maybe calm down a bit. Don't look at the news. Don't look at social media. Look at something nice and enjoyable. Maybe listen to the podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or you want to wish us a Merry Christmas, then please send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening to us all this year, right? Not only today, but all this year. Make sure to join us again next year when we continue to burst the Western bubble. That's it from my side, Balder. Which closing quote did you pick for us today?
I've got a quote here from former US President Lyndon B. Johnson, who said, "If future generations are to remember us more with gratitude than sorrow, we must achieve more than just the miracles of technology. We must also leave them a glimpse of the world as it was created, not just as it looked when we got through with it."